This is a CBC podcast.
Big Brother gets spanked. How to teach a dead frog new tricks. And IHateYoungPeople.com. Those are your keywords. I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine. Last week on Search Engine, we spoke about online privacy and how I don't care too much about it. As luck would have it, that same day, two important privacy stories hit the media. One of them became pretty big news, and one of them didn't. Now, you may have heard about the first one, how Canada's privacy commissioner is looking into whether or not Google's all-seeing Street View feature may be at odds with Canadian privacy laws. This is a good example of the kind of privacy that I don't really care too much about. Google Street View is very cool and useful, and I figure if the authorities are allowed to watch video footage from cameras planted all over Canadian cities, why can't I? But the other privacy story that dropped last week, well, that one has me rethinking whether or not digital privacy matters. It seems that while the privacy commissioner was trying to protect our privacy from Google, another arm of the Canadian government, namely Stockwell Day's Ministry, Public Safety Canada, may have been trying to find a way to compromise our privacy in a totally unprecedented way, giving police the right to demand all kinds of personal information about you from internet service providers, ISPs, without so much as a warrant. This is a strange story, and what you make of it depends on who you believe. We're going to try to sort it out right now, though, by talking to the two main people involved. Soon I'll speak to Stockwell Day. But first, I'm joined by the person responsible for making this story public in the first place, University of Ottawa law professor and internet privacy blogger Michael Geist. Michael, hello.
Hi, Jesse.
Michael, can you start at the beginning and tell me just what it is that happened or didn't happen to Canadian civil liberties last week?
Sure. Well, last week it came to my attention that the government was engaged in a semi-secret consultation on one aspect of lawful access, which is a long-standing attempt by law enforcement to obtain new powers with respect to the internet and other wireless communications. And lawful access would require ISPs to do things like install surveillance technologies, as well as, in this particular case, require ISPs to disclose customer name and address information.
So can you give me an example, like a practical example of, you know, in a world where this legislation had gone through, how would it be exercised?
Sure. You'd have an instance where someone from law enforcement would approach a larger ISP on a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week basis. And they, in some instances, would be providing them with paper saying, here's a particular person. I'd like their IP address and I'd like their other information that you have. Sometimes they might have nothing more than an IP address, a particular locator on the internet, and they'd like to link that with name and address so they could tie in certain kinds of activity that are taking place online with a particular person.
So they could come with just my email address or an anonymous comment I posted to a blog and then ask for, well, demand without a warrant all this other information about me, where I live, everything.
Sure, the extent to which the ISP has some of that information, they'd be required to disclose it. And indeed, the consultation even envisions the possibility of doing so with nothing more than a phone call.
Now, what is the purpose of these consultations?
Well, in some ways, it's hard to know exactly what the purpose of the consultation was, because it seemed as if government had already decided what it wanted to do. There was only one option put forward, that is, the information would be required to be handed over without a court order.
So they're asking you for your opinion on this, but the impression you got is that they were leading you in a very specific direction.
That was certainly the feeling I felt. It was fairly clear. It said that we're envisioning a single model, and the model itself didn't involve any sort of oversight. I was asked to keep the consultation confidential, and so I indicated that I would respect that in the sense that I wouldn't post the full consultation online, but felt that it was inappropriate not to disclose the fact that there was a consultation.
Okay, so you leak the story, other blogs pick up your story, and then it ends up in the mainstream press, and then someone leaks the document itself. Is that right?
That seems to be what happened. It made national news, and suddenly the document at first actually did appear on a news organization's website, although Public Safety moved fairly quickly after that to post it on its own site.
Well, one might ask what choice they had if it was already accessible.
Yeah, sure. Well, once it was out online, it made no sense to keep it private. But frankly, once the story itself was out there, it made no sense to keep it private because this, as I say, was really fueling fears about what lawful access is all about and concerns that government surveillance taking place in secret. And that certainly wouldn't help them push forward whatever agenda they might have.
Who do you think leaked the actual document?
That's hard to say, and in part because we don't know who else was included within the consultation process. So it's hard to even know who might have leaked it, in part because it's hard to know who actually had their hands on the document in the first place.
Now, so the first thing Public Safety Canada does is post the document and extend that period, but that wasn't the end of it. Stockwell Day later released a statement.
Right. And so I think it was a welcome comment and a rather surprise to some that Stockwell Day stepped forward later that day to indicate that, in fact, the government had no intention of requiring ISPs to disclose customer name and address information without court oversight, in a sense, reversing the consultation. But nevertheless, if you take his words at face value, and there's no reason not to, it would appear that the government has had a change of heart, not just on the consultation, but on the policy itself.
Well, let me ask you about that, in that there's no reason not to take his words at face value. It seems that he was suggesting that the whole thing was a misunderstanding and his office blamed it on the wording of the document. Do you find that credible?
Well, I mean, I think that from a political perspective, he was doing his best to spin this in a way that did the least amount of damage. But when Day says that his office wasn't consulted on the consultation itself and that he wouldn't have approved it had he had the chance to take a look, it's certainly within the realm of possibility that this was done at a bureaucratic level with the assistance of law enforcement and perhaps the minister wasn't included, though one would hope that on an issue of this import, you'd have the highest levels, including the minister, engaged.
But it does seem like someone in Public Safety Canada, whether it was Stockwell Day himself or some underling, was trying to get around warrants. Is that your impression?
It certainly does seem that way. And listen, law enforcement has never been shy about arguing that they believe this is a power that they need. But at the end of the day, what we have now is that in a span of 48 hours, we've gone from what looked like a semi-secret consultation with a closed world in terms of what the policy options were, to one in which the consultation will continue, with the minister now on record as stating that the government won't move forward with legislation that would remove court oversight. In many ways, we've seen the impact that blogs and the mainstream media, and I think public concern with this issue, can have on government policy in very, very short periods of time.
So as the authorities try to figure out how to watch us, we're keeping a very close eye on them.
I think so, and I think that all governments run real risks if they choose to ignore what's taking place online and what those large numbers of constituents are saying.
Michael, Stockwell Day's ministry wanted your opinion. They wanted to ask you some questions. What if you could ask them a question? What would it be?
Well, that's the toughest question you've asked me thus far. It's an interesting question. What would I mean, it's not so much a question, but rather a desire for an undertaking that they ensure that it all happened in an open and transparent fashion, recognizing that speaking to only a select group of stakeholders doesn't ensure that they get the full panoply of perspectives of Canadians, and that on these issues, which are so important to our privacy, civil liberties, and security, it's essential to ensure that everybody is included in the process.
Well, something tells me that if they do another secret consultation, you're one voice that might not be included.
I suppose that was a risk that I ran in ensuring that this most recent one was available to all.
Michael, thank you so much for talking with us today.
No, thanks for having me.
Search Engine called up Stockwell Day's office to ask him some questions of our own. Now, we were initially told that Minister Day had a very busy schedule and that they'd get back to us. We then decided to crowdsource this potential interview. We used our blog to ask listeners what questions they might have for Minister Day about this case. And many responded with many questions. Several other blogs picked up our request for this crowdsourced interview. Soon, Minister Day's office called us back to tell us that he would have time to speak to us after all. And the Honorable Stockwell Day now joins me from British Columbia. Hello, Minister Day.
Hi, Jess. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. As you know, the lawful access consultation has created a lot of concern, particularly by people who are active on the internet. And so what we've done is we've invited Canadians to submit questions about it to you through our website. We probably won't have time to get through all of their questions in the time we have today. So I'm going to try to paraphrase a couple and I'll quickly summarize the rest. Sound good?
That sounds good to me.
Okay. Now, with reference to the consultation being semi-secret, as Michael Geist put it, we received a number of questions from the public. Lindsay Noddle asks, we've all heard authorities use the soundbite, if you have nothing to hide, then you have nothing to fear. If the reverse is true, then what did the government fear when they decided to try and hide the consultations?
It's been a wide open consultation. I'm not sure why somebody thought otherwise. The consultation actually started even before we were in the government with the previous government, because it's technical stuff that's being looked at, and it's very wide open, and the consultation is going to continue till about the middle of October.
But Minister Day, if consultation wasn't hidden, then why did it have to be leaked?
There was one particular document that somebody said was leaked. Letters go out when we do a consultation. Things go up on websites. We have roundtables. We invite industry associations. When officials do consultation, it's multi-level. And somebody, I suppose, was, I don't know if they were upset because they didn't get a certain letter. I don't know what happened.
So Michael Geist wasn't told to not post the document on his website?
I certainly never told him that. Matter of fact, the document that he was talking about, I hadn't even seen. So, he doesn't have to feel badly. I hadn't seen that particular one either.
Well, let me ask you about that, about you having never seen it. We received some questions about that. Mark Wells wrote in to ask, if in fact you did not know about this, why didn't you?
Well, as I said, when a consultation goes on as broadly, as openly, and to as many different players as this one, sometimes officials, maybe well-meaning, send out letters or requests to different people. Not everything crosses my desk. And, I don't see every single document. Nothing should go out that it, in principle, hasn't been approved. And this particular document, as senior officials told me when they traced it down, didn't actually have official approval. But having said all that, we need to look at a situation today with technology as advanced as it is. Criminals, pedophiles, terrorists can be on the Internet with new technologies. And all we are asking for from the industry is, as an industry develops a new technology, a new way to communicate, that they also build into it intercept capacity. But it's always and would only be with a court-ordered warrant, not without a warrant. And that's what the legislation has to do. It has nothing to do with individual information about one-on-one subscribers.
Well, let me pick up on that, about what this consultation was really about, because it seems like there's a great deal of confusion. As I understand your position, you're saying that it's just this technical issue and it wasn't about going around the warrant system. And I think your office said that it was bad wording in the document. I'm looking at the document right now, and I'm reading directly from it. It says, law enforcement agencies have been experiencing difficulties in consistently obtaining basic CNA information. Some companies provide this information voluntarily, while others require a warrant. This poses a problem. So the question many people wrote in to ask is, what other possible meaning can be derived from the wording in this document?
Well, that's, as I've said, Jess, that's one of who knows how many documents and consultations that went out. I don't know why that particular official or whoever sent it out had that particular idea. Maybe it was from the former Liberal legislation, because the Liberals tabled legislation that would allow that type of garnering of information without a warrant. So, you know, I can't, I'm not going to apologize for whoever wrote the article, and I would suggest, I appreciate the thoroughness with which you're asking the questions, Jess, and I would suggest that if the person who wrote the article hadn't done it in such a volatile way, maybe he would have understood it when he did his article, because that approach, the without warrant approach, is being supported by Stefanzio, and we are not supporting that.
Well, this was a document that was released by your ministry, and Elizabeth Maxson wrote in to ask, who do you believe is ultimately responsible for the actions of your ministry?
Minister is always responsible. That's why I'm taking responsibility right now.
But you won't apologize.
Pardon me?
But you won't apologize for...
Well, I'm explaining the difference between our legislation and former Liberal legislation.
Well, let me give you your due that at least the way this is all shaken out, you have taken the position at this point that this is off the table. And a lot of the feedback we got from our audience was not really questions for you, but so much concerns about our civil liberties. And there are a lot of comparisons to the Patriot Act and wiretapping. People are very concerned about this. So let me summarize their concerns by asking you this, Minister Day. Can you assure the Canadian people that this issue of circumventing warrants for online information is now off the table for good?
We never put it there, Jess, and I share their concerns, and I'm glad that people send in the questions, glad you've raised them, and I hope that people understand that when we say we are not in any way, shape, or form wanting extra powers to police to pursue items without warrants, that is not what our purported legislation is going to be doing. That was previous Liberal legislation. That is not the path that we're walking down at all.
Well, I think everyone's glad to hear that. It's kind of funny. It's good to hear that you're concerned about these civil liberties as well. And just thinking about the whole case, it's funny that it's all about people, Minister Day, feeling nervous about having their privacy invaded on the internet. But in this case, the only person who's had their privacy invaded in all this is you. Your ministry is the one who's had its documents posted on the web for the world to see. And my question is, do you feel violated, Minister Day?
No, not at all. There's no state secrets are released. No, this is not a national security issue. This is, you know, somebody's letter that went out. No, not at all.
Minister Day, thank you so much for your time this morning.
All right, thanks for your questions, and thanks to the listeners for their good questions, too.
Stockwell Day is Canada's Minister of Public Safety, and he spoke to me by phone from British Columbia. I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine, a collaborative public radio show. Now, what that means, among other things, is that from time to time, we'll issue collective journalistic assignments that we call mob docs. So, once again, what's a mob doc? Well, a mob doc is a radio documentary where anyone in our audience, anywhere in the world, is a potential freelance reporter. You send us an audio clip on a given subject, and we'll then weave together the most compelling submissions into a finished documentary, which we'll broadcast on the radio. And if we use your recording, we'll pay you, the same as we would any freelancer. Our current Mob Docs assignment asks the question, what does the internet sound like? On our first show, I played you some tape recorded in an internet cafe inside Jerusalem's ancient old quarter. And last week, I played you a submission we received from a mom in Vancouver, whose daughter can't get enough of the virtual community Club Penguin. Today, Mob Docs continues with this upload we received from Brady Marks.
Hi there, my name's Brady Marks, and we're listening to the sound of the internet, or at least a small corner of the internet, a file sharing network, and each little blip and buzz you can hear is someone somewhere pressing enter and firing off a search. The sound is produced by a program which intercepts these searches and turns them into sound. It's Monday, just after 8 o'clock, September 10th, 2007. People are searching for Tic Tac, Pink, Beyonce, Pussycat, a lot of MP3s, movies, some pornography, and wares or illegal software.
That's what the internet sounds like inside of a computer program written by Brady Marks. Now, to upload a clip of what the internet sounds like where you are, come to cbc.ca/search engine and look for Mob Docs. If you're just joining us, I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine, a radio show that predicts the present. At the dawn of the internet age, much was heralded of the promise that this new form of communication would bring. For education, for arts and culture, and for society at large. Well, the internet's promise has been fulfilled. Things that at one time seemed unimaginable are now part of our everyday world. And to give us one example is Saskatoon-born Fulbright scholar and media artist, Garnet Hertz. Hello, Garnet.
Hi.
Garnet, I'm looking at a picture of your project, and maybe this will work best if you describe to our listeners what it is I'm looking at.
Sure. This project, at its heart of it, is a miniature computer about the size of a deck of playing cards that is put inside of this body of this preserved frog, the kind of frog that you have to dissect in high school.
Right.
And people can log into the computer that actually resides inside of this frog's body.
Mm-hmm.
And through this website that's actually contained in the body, they can make the legs of the frog kick. And so people from around the internet can log in and make this thing move.
So anyone around the world can log into the site and make this dead frog kick through a mini computer that you've implanted in its corpse.
Yeah, exactly.
Garnet, why did you do this?
Well, I had been reading about and researching this Italian guy hundreds of years ago who had done experiments with jumping frog legs and had discovered by accident that electricity made muscle tissue contract and move. And this led to a whole series of speculations and kind of a frenzy related to electricity being a fluid of life and led to things like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and created a real cultural sensation. So the idea of combining the frog with the electricity, that historical element, with the internet, which, you know, you could think of as the year 2000 equivalent in terms of hype, putting those two things together is a way to take the new and the old thing together and compress them into a single object.
Is there any commercial application to this?
No. There's no commercial application to it. And since building this project several years ago, I've retired from doing anything with animals ever again. So.
Oh, why is that?
People have a fascination with it, but also there's a shock factor to it, and it just kind of gets tiring after a while.
Mm-hmm.
So, or maybe I'm getting older and stuff, you know, mellowing out.
Once you've seen a dead frog kick on the internet, it's got to move on. So what's your next project?
It actually relates to photography. It's very straight-up sort of studio art thing compared to this frog. But after I built the frog, I had made a robot that was controlled by a cockroach, which is a whole other story. We don't have time to talk about that now, but
we're going to have to come back to that some other time.
Yeah.
Garnet, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Yeah, thanks. Nice to talk to you.
Okay. Garnet Hertz is a Fulbright scholar and a doctoral student at the University of California, Irvine. He spoke to us today from his home. I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine, which, as mentioned earlier, is a collaborative radio show. Now, one way we work with our listeners is by posting our stories to our blog as soon as we start chasing them. That way, we can invite you to come discuss and debate these stories before we go to broadcast, and that helps us make better radio. But we also welcome collaboration in a very old-fashioned way. Namely, our door is always open for your story pitches. If you know of something going on that we should be talking about on Search Engine, interesting ways that the internet is changing politics and art and culture, or some great Creative Commons music that we could use on the show, let us know, either by sending us an email at searchengine@cbc.ca or by using the story pitch form on our blog, which is at cbc.ca/searchengine. The internet is a young medium, and so are the majority of the people who use it. Its content and idiom and attitude tend to reflect this youthful perspective in a way that can sometimes obscure the opinions and expressions of the older generations. It's with this inequity in mind that we end our show today with some of the voices found on one of last week's most popular websites, IHateYoungPeople.com. Enjoy.
What bugs me about young people is they have bad manners, they won't get up for elderly people on the bus, and they won't cover their mouth when they yawn.
They step on your feet. You know, they don't say, excuse me, it's like they don't have no upbringing.
When I listen to the music, I don't like it. I don't like rap music. Give me the old-fashioned rock and roll where it's all love songs.
You know, I'm 43. When I was coming up, you know, my mom's taught me mannerisms. You taught me how to say thank you, be courteous, be polite.
You got out of line. Not only did you get it from your parents, but your teachers.
You got, basically, you got the iron and core. You got backslap. So.
Yeah. You got to beat your ass. Ain't no timeout. Because they don't listen, no matter what you try. Should nuts be at a rod is an old tradition that should be passed on from generations to generations, man. My mother bust my ass. I'm glad she did.
We were taught that sex was for marriage and that was it. And when a guy tried to get fresh with me, I slapped him.
When I was growing up, the old people in our neighborhood was part of a big community. They would bust your ass when you do something wrong, take you home by pulling your ass and tell your mother what you did. That's a double ass whipping.
They don't know anything that doesn't come off of the internet or the TV. They don't know about books, libraries, real life, the theater, cinema. They don't know about history.
That's why I hate kids.
Well, if you hate kids too, you can upload your thoughts on the subject to IHateYoungPeople.com, where you can also listen to other people's hatred of the young. Search Engine is produced by myself, Jeff Siskin, Andrea Morales, and the Search Engine online community. We make the show through online collaboration. To get involved, visit our site, cbc.ca/search engine, where you'll also find links and discussion on every story we've talked about today, plus our podcast. You can also find us on the Facebook group Search Engine CBC or by email at searchengine@cbc.ca. I'm Jesse Brown. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.